Studio 360.
This hour, we're going to talk all about unfinished business in the arts. But first, let's raise a glass.
In my family, we think the wine you drink the most should be the best. We like Paul Masson's Burgundy.
Toward the end of his life, Orson Welles was better known for making commercials like that one for California Wine than making movies. His filmmaking life had begun brilliantly with Citizen Kane, which he wrote and directed at age 25. But then his career foundered. He decamped to Europe, and by the 1970s and 80s, lots of people considered Welles somewhere between self-indulgent and self-parody.
We will sell no wine before it's time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the public perception of late Orson is that, kind of a has-been doing wine commercials.
This is the documentary filmmaker Morgan Neville, best known for 20 Feet from Stardom, which won an Oscar in 2014, and earlier this year, Won't You Be My Neighbor, his lovely portrait of Fred Rogers.
The fact of the matter is, he was taking all of that money and making films. I mean,
right.
He said, as an actor, I am a prostitute, but as a director, I remain virginal.
Right. Starting in 1970, Orson Welles was pouring his money and effort into one movie in particular, The Other Side of the Wind.
And this film kind of consumed him for many years. He tried to finish it for the rest of his life.
And in fact, he died in 1985 with the movie still unfinished. He'd shot hundreds of hours of footage, but before and after his death, it was ensnared in these Byzantine financial and legal complications for decades. The governments of France and of Iran were part of the mess.
I mean, it's probably the most famous movie never released until now.
Because now, almost half a century after he started shooting The Other Side of the Wind, Orson Welles' last film, a version of it, is finally out.
Movies and friendship, those are mysteries.
A mystery may reveal, it never explains.
Just like you, Mr. Hannaford.
Just like me and God. If it weren't for the difference in sex, how could you tell us apart?
The Other Side of the Wind has been assembled and finished by the director Peter Bogdanovich and producer Frank Marshall, both of whom were part of the original production. And you can see it on Netflix as of November 2nd. But probably more interesting to more people than Welles' movie is the epic and fraught tale of its making, which is where Morgan Neville comes in.
I knew about the film, and I just kept thinking if I could ever get my hands on this footage that's
right.
been locked away for decades.
Right.
I would love to make a documentary about it.
And voila, his new documentary, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, superbly chronicles that story. And it too is coming now on Netflix.
The Other Side of the Wind is a movie about a film director at the end of his life that comes back to America to finish a movie that he can't finish. And obviously, this is a very meta story because this is exactly what was happening in Orson Welles' life at the time. And, you know, even though Orson hated to ever think of his own movies as being autobiographical,
right. They
were all autobiographical in different ways.
Well, and this one, so clearly, I mean, the central character played by John Huston is an aging famous film director. So not only is The Other Side of the Wind an unfinished film about the fictional making of an unfinished film about the film world and contains a film within the film and a documentary crew shooting the director making the film. So here's your documentary about
yes.
the whole thing, right? I mean, it's the kind of thing people say, oh, it makes my head explode.
Orson was not shy of being meta about these things. And then my approach to it was to be very open about the documentary we're making about the documentary, about the feature, about the filmmaker. I basically did audio interviews and had a camera person document me doing audio interviews because I wanted to show the mechanics of me actually doing the interviews. You know, and in a way that was The Other Side of the Wind, but it's also Citizen Kane, which
right.
is framed
right.
with a journalist interviewing people about who Charles Foster Kane was.
Right. I want to watch a clip with you of your doc, which is called The Love Me When I'm Dead. This is Orson Welles talking to some reporters in the 1970s about this movie, The Other Side of the Wind, that he was then working on.
What will really be the big basic differences between this picture and anything else you've ever done?
Because everything else I've ever done has been controlled. Every frame is controlled.
But I would like to take a whole story
and make the picture
As though it were a documentary, the actors are going to be improvised.
Have you done that kind of thing before with other films?
Nobody's ever done it before, you know.
But that seems to me like shooting and shooting, and aren't you afraid the end result won't have any control?
Not a bit. No, I really am not.
Prophetic, that reporter.
Absolutely. What he's talking about there and what became kind of the big theme, particularly of his later directing process, was he came to believe that the director was somebody who presides over accidents.
Right. And he says that many times.
He does. And that's his job description. I think most filmmakers try to avoid accidents, but Orson leaned into them. And if things were going too smoothly under production, he would be the first person to throw a hand grenade into the situation.
So this movie of his, The Other Side of the Wind, is supposed to be taking place over one night at basically a single location, which is funny because, as you show in your film, Orson actually had to recreate this setting in different countries over all these years and then fake that it was happening in the same place. We just heard him say that he meant it to look like a documentary, documenting this wild party.
It's a birthday party for this film director, right. Jake Hannaford.
Played by John Huston.
The idea is there are cineasts and film crews and film students shooting every angle of it in every imaginable format, and that what is constructed at the end is all the scraps from this party, from all these different cameras, put together into a documentary.
We're the close-up on Hannaford people.
And these ladies are from Life,
here,
I guess.
Look over here.
I'm independent.
Hister from the Film Institute.
So it's a found footage film, which, if it had come out at the time, I think it would have been the first found footage feature ever done.
Yeah, very, you know, 21st century avant-garde, yes. Seeming, right?
So many people talked about the fact that if Orson was around today, how much he would have loved the fact that you could shoot a movie on a phone and edit it on a laptop.
No kidding.
And when you look at the kind of editing he was doing, sometimes hundreds of edits in a scene. I mean, absolutely staggering editing. And he was doing it the old-fashioned way on a flatbed, a Steenbeck, with physical tape and film,
yeah,
is unbelievable.
Let's watch a clip of The Other Side of the Wind, of this party, that demonstrates his loose mockumentary style. In this scene is Peter Bogdanovich, the real-life director of Last Picture Show and Paper Moon, who is playing a movie director and here arguing with a film critic character and with John Huston, the film director John Huston, also playing a film director.
I mean, how much harm can you do to the third biggest grosser in movie history?
Really make that much? How marvelous.
Yes. Did you know that when his own production company goes public, that your friend there stands to walk away with $40 million?
Yeah, and she's going to say that I'm just going to keep on writing that I stole everything from you, Skipper. I'm never going to walk away from that.
Well, it's all right to borrow from each other. What we must never do is borrow from ourselves.
Come on.
I mean, this movie seems so different than the movies we know Orson Welles for. I mean, you know, Magnificent Ambersons, Lady from Shanghai, or Citizen Kane, they seem so precise and so rigorous. And this is so, like, let's go crazy, kind of Dennis Hopper-y late 60s.
He was very aware of what was happening in the film world at the time.
Right.
And it's worth saying that the movie, within the movie, In the Other Side of the Wind, is this satire, essentially, of atmospheric European cinema, films like Antonioni.
Right. This is the movie that Huston's character is making, pieces of which we see the film within the film in these long, groovy, semi-psychedelic scenes with no dialogue.
It's basically a guy following a woman.
Yeah.
Around a city. And there's some beautiful images he makes for this kind of satirical version of this European cinema. And he kind of felt like, oh, I could do that in my sleep. You know, are you kidding? You know, so you want some of that? Here's some of that.
Right. So at the end, when he died, there was all this film tonnage that he'd shot. What shape was it in? And were you working with Bogdanovich's team as they pieced together Orson's film?
We were doing two projects at once. You know, we were getting the footage at the same time, day after day. But there was kind of a firewall between the two films. So we were making our documentary on our own. And then there was another team of people led by Peter Bogdanovich and Frank Marshall who were restoring the film and trying to actually finish Orson's feature. So that was a gargantuan task. So there are about 100 hours of dailies. And the thing is, Orson shot this over years. So you know, a normal movie would have a shooting ratio of maybe 7 to 1. This is a ratio of maybe 50 to 1. So there was so much more footage. And of course, the way Orson shot it willy-nilly over years and many different continents meant that it was odds and ends and scraps and, of
course, different formats, right?
Different formats, Super 8, 16, 35. And so as we were working on the film, the footage was coming in dribs and drabs. So every day you would get a batch of odds and ends. It was like random puzzle pieces, and you didn't know how they belonged and what they fit into. But also, normally what you would do on a feature is you would have, you know, script notes and script supervisor who carefully organized everything. Right. There was none of that. They weren't even sure if Orson had actually shot the entire film. He had said he had shot the whole film, but Orson said a lot of things that, you know.
Right.
So it was really a puzzle to put together.
Right. I want to watch another clip from one of the many meta scenes in The Other Side of the Wind, which is Welles' film. Describe what's going on as we watch together.
And if there is a bomb, when does it blow up?
Well, we don't actually know.
So this is Jake Hannaford's producer pitching Jake's new film to the studio boss.
What do we know?
You better ask Jake.
I'd better read the script.
The studio boss is a thinly veiled version of Robert Evans, who was running Paramount at the time.
Oh, there isn't one. Jake is just making it up as he goes along.
He's done it before.
Now, in that scene, is there a script? There is no script. From watching your documentary and watching the film, one wonders, like, was there a master plan, or was it too much making it up as you go along? Do you have a sense of, like, what was he really doing as he was doing it?
Well, there was a script. The thing was, very few people ever saw it, and he constantly rewrote it. So virtually every night at the end of shooting, he would start writing more pages. And those pages would sometimes be given to the actors, sometimes not, sometimes kind of randomly. The overwhelming sense I got from everybody I talked to was, I have no idea what this movie's about, but Orson does.
Yeah.
So as much as there was mass confusion on the part of the crew, everybody was certain that Orson knew exactly what he wanted.
Right. What do you think, though, looking at it in retrospect as the figure out of this puzzle, did he?
I'm not sure, honestly. I think there were times when he did, but I think he just kept reinventing it. I think he would have an answer, and as soon as he had that answer, it would slip through his fingers, and he'd say, well, what could it become now?
Right.
It was constantly morphing. And then as he was editing, it was being reinvented one more time, and he believed in that, the idea that it's never
It's all in the editing, he says, in your film.
He does. And he believed that. He believed you could make it into a completely different movie in the edit.
Right. And whatever one might say about this film, he had ambition for it being his greatest work. It's always my next work is my greatest.
Exactly. And it's incredibly ambitious. I mean, one thing I will say is that when it came to his art, he had no sense that it was beneath him to do whatever it took to make his films the way he wanted to make them. So if it meant that he had to crawl into the back seat of a car with a blanket over his head to sneak onto a back lot to get a shot for free, he would do it.
This long 6-year process of filming Other Side of the Wind obviously tested lots of the relationships in his life. You focus on one that I knew nothing about in your film, about his cinematographer, a guy called Gary Graver. Tell us about him.
I mean, Gary is really the person who this is all kind of a tribute to. I mean, Gary was somebody who basically gave his life for The Other Side of the Wind. He was a cinematographer, kind of a working B-movie cinematographer in Hollywood. When he heard that Orson Welles had come back to America and was staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel, so Gary calls Orson.
And to my surprise, he answered the phone. Hello? I said, Orson Welles?
Hello.
I said, I'm Gary Graver. I'm an American cameraman.
Come and talk to me.
I've got to talk to you.
I want to talk to you now.
And he said, get over to the Beverly Hills Hotel right away. Wow.
And so Orson and Gary begin this collaboration where Gary ends up shooting everything Orson directs for the last 15 years of his life.
Right.
Gary was somebody who believed The Other Side of the Wind would legitimize him as a filmmaker and as a cinematographer. And the more elusive it became, the more kind of tragic it becomes to me. Gary went through multiple divorces during this time. He didn't get to see his kids much, and he couldn't have a normal cinematographer's job. So,
because Orson might just call him and say, hey, I need you here and wherever.
Exactly. Orson could make incredibly unreasonable demands of the people around him. And when people couldn't ultimately live up to those demands, he would see this as evidence of his view of human nature, that people weren't trustworthy and faithful and people could betray him. Gary was the one person who never betrayed Orson because he sacrificed everything in his life for Orson.
John Huston, he directed great films, Maltese Falcon, The African Queen, The Man Who Would Be King. And he acted a lot, especially when he was older, like in Chinatown. Getting to see him here, a new John Huston movie, is a real treat.
It is. I'm a huge Huston fan. And what's really interesting is that John Huston and Orson were part of a club that maybe just was the two of them. You know, that they were both actor directors. They both came from the same generation. And I think they both loved and respected each other tremendously. There weren't a lot of people that I think Orson felt that way about, like he did about John Huston.
And manly men who could make fun of being manly men.
Exactly. Yeah, all that. Yeah. Like, I think they really, really enjoyed each other. And Orson acted in three of John Huston's films, too.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. But Orson kept feeling that perhaps I should be playing this role.
Right.
But if I play this role, everybody's going to think it's me. Yeah. And I don't want people to think it's me. And he said the only person in the world who could play this role is John Huston. Yeah.
Your film is delightful, and it's very fast-paced, not to say frenetic, but fast-paced, and this unusual pace as well. And it has these brief, funny, cinematic punctuations throughout and a kind of occasionally comic scoring. It's just terrific, but it's not like your work, right? Was part of your thinking like, I want to make a movie that Orson Welles would have liked?
Sure. I felt like I had not just permission, but responsibility to take chances.
Uh-huh.
Because if you're spending that much time looking at a character like Orson and seeing how many extreme chances he took at every possible turning point, it inspires you to say, you know, this is an opportunity to do whatever I would normally do here. Let me think about how to do it differently.
Right.
To do a down-the-middle, straight making of documentary would be doing him a huge disservice.
You released earlier this year another great documentary about another iconic American media figure, Mr. Rogers.
And I saw this new thing called television, and I saw people throwing pies in each other's faces. And I thought, this could be a wonderful tool. Why is it being used this way?
He and Orson Welles seem as close to opposite figures of humanity as one can imagine. But they're both quixotic, singular characters, right?
They are. They are. I mean, I've just started to think about this because I knew people like you would be asking me about it.
Thank you. Thank you for being of service in that.
But when you think about somebody like Fred Rogers and Orson Welles in the same sentence, I think one thing that unifies them is they were people who really didn't care what the popular opinion was.
Right.
People who marched to their own drummer, who really had their own vision that really worked in kind of a pure way. I mean, they were kind of pure artists in that way. I mean, they were people who said, this is what I want to do. I don't care if it makes money. I don't care if people like it. I don't care if it goes against conventional wisdom, but this is what I believe.
Morgan Neville's new documentary, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, is out on Netflix, which is where you can also see the brand new 40-year-old Orson Welles film, The Other Side of the Wind. If you're planning a double feature, I would definitely advise watching the documentary first. And for the record, Morgan and I have worked on some projects together that, appropriately, have not yet come to fruition.